I understand that ultimately old age, sickness, and death are out of our control, but we can influence those factors by how we treat our physicality, our nature. Can you talk about a skillful relationship to the body? What is skillful to let be versus what is skillful to influence? P.S. May Ajahn Yatiko's organism heal quickly. Well, one of the things that you there was the other day we chanted the recollections on the requisites, so that the requisites of robes, food, shelter, but the last one is medicine for when we're sick, so that's a say right from the Buddha's time, looking after the body in order to try to have some ease, and of course being able to take that ease and being able to continue practicing, so that looking after the body is also has to be balanced with not getting too worried, too obsessed about it, and it always has to be held in the context of the the reality of somewhat frail nature of the physical existence. So it is just balancing that, and again, that's where that reflecting on the increase in the wholesome, decrease in the unwholesome, or increase in unwholesome and decrease in wholesome, in the sense if we're getting too worried, too upset, too obsessed about our body, our health, then we're going to experience an increase in unwholesome mental states. Whereas if there's a good balance and a healthy attitude, then there's going to be a sense of an increase of wholesome mental states and well-being. Thank you for mentioning the usefulness of the recollections, Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, etc. I also found Ajahn Kurundamo's statement helpful about not living in the past. Could you clarify how to recollect without living in a past good experience? Taking a past good experience and then using it to inform the present, say, in an uplifting way, in an energizing way, in a way that leads to increased reflection and consideration, then that's a useful way to use the past. I mean, sometimes there's a misunderstanding or a misconception. As an ideal practitioner is sort of just completely grounded in the present moment and doesn't have any thoughts of the past or the future. And that's not the case at all. The Buddha was more than capable of planning and building on his experience and using past experience to inform the present. And then even just reflecting into the future to sort of see, well, what is a useful course of action? What's a beneficial way forward? When it's not useful is when we take a past good experience and then we're constantly comparing whatever we're experiencing to some idealized past that is of dubious kind of veracity. Oftentimes there's a certain fantasy about that, of how good it really was. Yeah, it's not like the good old days. we easily drift into that nostalgia, and then we comparing our present experience to some idealized and somewhat disembodied experience, so that's when it gets unskillful, and one needs to distance oneself from that kind of living in the past. But the it's with wisdom that we take the experiences that we have. We take the experience that we had and really, really learn from that. This is actually a question for Debbie.
Okay, if I may, I'd ask Debbie a question. I'd like to know if she ever considered ordaining as a nun, why or why not. If there had been a Theravadin monastery for nuns 15 years ago in the Bay Area, would that have affected her decision? Many thanks. I considered ordaining in the early days, and I was actually I took my first retreat in Thailand, and on my way back to the States, I ended up in England and spent time at Amaravati in Chithurst. And I wept as I left, but I had to come back and pay off a debt that I owed to my parents, a financial debt. And something in me knew, as hard as it was to leave, that was the right thing to be doing. Sometimes it's something you don't really comprehend, but I was aware that it felt like the right thing to do, and I never had any doubts. It's something I've never doubted. Then I considered several times going back. But I don't know, I wasn't pulled strongly enough, and then by the time with Sangapala and things got going here, Sangapala is for those who don't know, is the steward foundation for the monastery for Abhayagiri, and that's the group that invited the Ajahn Sumedho to send some monks over so that we could start a monastery in California. And I suppose I got somewhat invested in that pretty quickly. And then when Longpo Pasano came, when the monastery opened, I had met him in Thailand and felt that I really could learn a great deal from him. And so that also kind of added to the mix. And by the time I decided to move up to the monastery, I think I decided that was where I wanted to be and how I wanted to do it. And I don't have any doubts that I made the right decision, because that's been a really good place of learning for me, and I've really grown a lot in my time there. And I feel I still have a lot of growth that I can do there.
Am I not ambitious enough or not believing enough in getting enlightened this lifetime? I don't want to stress myself out with something I have no control over. Balancing life with my practice, enjoying some quality of life in the circle of family and friends, and enlightenment would be a bonus. So it's... I think that the... sometimes it can easily be a real obsession with enlightenment, attainment, achieving something, and I think the reality, as I mentioned a few times, it comes from causes, and if we're just willing to put the causes in, continually put those causes in, then it it's just it'll work out in its own way. So that sense of Yeah, I mean, there's a balance that needs to actually take place, and so that really learning how to live in accordance with Dhamma and paying attention to the those foundations of the path and the truths. In reality, in terms of bringing the, you know, without even thinking about enlightenment or what enlightenment is, that living with generosity and kindness and precepts and virtue and mindfulness and discernment, relinquishment, all of these are incredibly good things that bring happiness, as well as the possibility of freedom, so that we as we continue to do it, it has its own reward, it has its own fruit. what comes to mind is a cartoon that was a few years ago, and at a very big big United Nations global kind of symposium and conference on climate change and global warming and the cartoon there's this all these people and there's a couple people standing and talking and it's sort of there's like clean air and sustainable cities and healthy food and balanced families and all that. What if we do all this and it's a hoax? And the reality is of course that's you know what if we could even live that way, even if it weren't for climate change and glow and all that, if we could live like that, it would be a good thing. Outside retreat, I sit daily, but samadhi is usually conspicuous by its absence. Do you have any words of advice, encouragement, or consolation? Well, the fact that one sits daily is already that in itself is one is seeing the benefit. Otherwise, one wouldn't do it. And even if these how one is conceiving of samadhi as some kind of extremely calm, refined state of consciousness, or what? I'm not sure. But just the fact that one sits daily, and one has that sustained period of quiet time, of mindfulness, of awareness, that is a really, really good thing. Also, I think one of the things that's really helpful to consider that when we, when the mind is a bit unwieldy or it's not as mindful and settled as we would like, that there's many other things that we can be doing. And one of the things that just comes to mind is paying attention to, like, directing our attention rather than just sort of banging away at the at the breath and trying to force the mind to be peaceful. Taking just a theme like in the Eightfold Path of, let's say, like Samma Sankappa, that right intention, right thought, right resolution, so that when we direct our attention to, because the Buddha puts the aspects of right thought or right intention into the framework of say thoughts of renunciation, thoughts of non-ill will, thoughts of harming. So that's how it's usually written or how it's described, because the Buddha is very precise, and he sets the bar at what we can at least do. But what that also does is once we start to cultivate and the mind directs itself to what is there's a momentum of what is wholesome and skillful. Thoughts of renunciation are really what will thoughts of, and the other thoughts will be thoughts of generosity, thoughts of loving kindness, thoughts of compassion. But the thing is, the Buddha is very skillful in that he doesn't mandate that. If one can just refrain from thoughts of violence and harming, thoughts of irritation and ill will, or thoughts of being able to renounce the kind of grasping mind. So what will naturally come up are the mind will incline more toward generosity, loving kindness, compassion, and as one is able to redirect one's thoughts in that way, and that building up that wholesome stream, that tends to settle the mind quite naturally, because the when there's a quality of well-being, increased well-being within the heart, then the mind settles. So that, sometimes we try too hard. Sometimes we or just do the meditation mechanically, so it's like really investigating what kind of thoughts we're bringing to it. Because we tend to, if our samadhi, our meditation is not so steady, then there's and there's going to be thoughts. So then taking those thoughts and then redirecting that energy in a wholesome way. And that tends to settle things. Your generosity is so appreciated. Thank you for your talk on the four types of concentration. I've never heard it so clearly explained. Two questions. How does one practice with the perception of light? I was told to ignore it as a nimitta, and that it was a metaphor. So I've quit mentioning it. There's two ways that when the Buddha describes that perception of light, it's both in terms of perception of light as a brightness, a brightening of the mind, and then a perception of light in terms of the bringing that quality of light into the, as if it were day, even if it were at night, so that there's this, because just naturally, if you perceive it's daytime, then you're going to be alert and awake. Remember that being up above the Arctic Circle one time, the sun never going down, so, well, it's really You know, didn't sleep very much while I was there. It was a perception of light. It's just this natural result. So then one actually generates that as a perception in the mind. Similarly, when one's one's meditating, because sometimes you can do that either on its own or in conjunction. One of the ways that I found useful is just using it in conjunction with the breath, so that perceive it rather than just paying attention to the physical sensation, but then also perceiving that sensation of breath as a sensation of light coming in and out of the body, and that tends to energize and also makes it interesting. Perhaps more important, how to practice with the rising and passing away of khandhas, as in the fourth development. Does one reflect on the process of being? And sanya is always unclear to me, perception. Okay, that's just taking these functions of nature, of the body, physical body, physical form, and paying attention to that, and it's both in terms of its coming into being and passing away, or how we experience it, and then feeling as the pleasant, painful, neutral feeling, just the feeling tone of an experience, whether it's a physical experience or a emotional experience. Perception, sanya, is the is both memory and perception as the function of mind that sort of allocates things in terms of this is important, this is not important, this is interesting, this is not interesting, and of course that's intertwined because we rely on information from our memory to inform a kind of a value that we place on experience, so that memory and perception are it's one word. It's a memory's last perception. How we perceive things and what that perceptual process does in terms of seeding the inclinations of the mind, and in what we tend to think about, ponder about, proliferate about, as the kind of the next stage, which is mental formations. Mental formations are your thinking processes. Your mindfulness is a mental formation. Wisdom is a mental formation. Loving kindness is a mental formation. Anger is a mental formation. Doubt's a mental formation. These are where our thoughts go to. And then consciousness is just the conscious cognition of the experience. So then recognizing those as they come into being, as they pass away, and then how they form the basis of our perception of self, perception of me. Because that's the in terms of the goal of these investigation and mindfulness practices is really to shine a light on the constructed nature of how we identify with experience and then assume a solid sense of self, of I, of me, of mine. Today is my 66th birthday. Could we please chant the recollection of sharing blessings to recognize it? Lots of birthdays in this retreat. Chanting requests, that's great. There are two different Pali words that are translated as compassion in our chants. Karuna, which is the Brahma Vihara, and Anukampa, as in compassion for later generations. Do these two words have different meanings in Pali? Well spotted. they don't have different meanings, but they have different connotations, in the sense that karuna, as a Brahma Vihara, is a mental state, a meditative state, a mature emotion, and anukampa is active application of compassion, so that anukampa is the applying of compassion into action, so that they get the same word, but one is more of a mental state, the other is the action, the activity involved. Is a monk allowed to hug his mother? No, he's not. And if you don't think that creates problems. There. Would you discuss Buddhist rites and rituals concerning death and dying? What are the rites surrounding the death and cremation of an arhat? Just in case. I won't go into real detailed. And as soon as you start talking about, say, rites and rituals, it's specific to particular, say, cultures, Buddhist culture in Thai Theravada will be slightly different from other Buddhist countries. And then even if you're in Thailand, the culture and ritual and ceremony will be somewhat different in different areas of Thailand. It'll be differ if you're in the countryside or in the city. So there's a lot of range. So to say Buddhist rites and rituals as if it were one coherent thing is not really so, but cremation is the predominant way of dealing with dying. Around the time of death or approaching death, then of course there's a lot of emphasis on helping the person to recollect what is wholesome, what is a refuge, so that there'll be usually be relatives or friends, or they'll or they invite monks to come and do chanting and give teachings at the bedside while somebody is dying. So there's, but a lot of it is on in ways of establishing mindfulness, allaying fear and confusion, and encouraging wholesome mental state, so that the passing is one of is peaceful and clear, and that's the main function. And then after death, then generally, say like I spent the vast majority of my time in living in Thailand in a forest monastery that actually was a cremation ground, a charnel ground. That's what it was. And then they invited the monks to come and live there, so that it continued to be a place where the villagers would bring their dead. And in the countryside, then you know, things are pretty straightforward. You usually know when somebody's died in the village. When in the morning time, there's a bunch of the men will show up and start collecting firewood, and getting ready for a cremation. They wouldn't keep the body. It'd be within 20. If somebody died at night, next afternoon is when you would do the cremation. Now with an increased dispersion of relatives and friends, more mobile society, then oftentimes the cremation won't take place for 3 days, 7 days. It's, you know, as soon as they can get the relatives together. And so there's a whole, kind of cottage industry in refrigerated coffins. So, I mean, because one of the reasons you just go ahead and do the cremation within 24 hours is in a tropical country, you don't want to be keeping it very long. It gets ripe real quick. But it's also very, everybody comes. My experience is one of being in a village, and death is out in the open. Everybody grows up seeing people dying. Houses are very open. People live close together. You know when somebody's ill. Everybody goes to visit. They know when somebody dies. Everybody helps out. Everybody comes, brings the body out. Everybody's there. They pour water onto the. It's like a blessing, with just a little sprinkle of water each person, and you're giving your good wishes to that person, and then everybody from the kids, older people, relatives. So everybody's involved. Everybody sees what's happening. Nothing's hidden. It's very quite healthy. And then after the cremation, then there's the ashes will be gathered, and the remains of bones and ashes will be kept after 3 days, and one continues to do ceremonies after that, and you keep a portion of those the ashes and bones to do ceremonies in the future, after 7 days, 50 days, 100 days, a year. So you continue to dedicate blessings to somebody who has passed away. And then for, say, for somebody who's considered an arahant, then it's a lot more complicated. There's usually, say, with Ajahn Chah, then the cremation took place a year after he passed away, so we kept the body for a year, and that's interesting. Also, there wasn't any didn't have refrigerated coffins in those days, so we had a coffin that was what they use. It's traditional method, and you use had a bed of tobacco about that thick on the bottom, and then you packed tobacco and then tea, just ordinary green tea, around the body. So the coffin was filled up after. So what that did was any fluids, body fluids, then are drawn, and it takes the smell away, so that when we changed the coffin just a few days before the cremation, and we did it really because there was ceremonies going during the cremation ceremony of Ajahn Chah. Was 10 days of meditation, chanting, practice, as a expression of gratitude, there were there's about 5,000 or 6,000 monks there in the monastery, about 500 or 1,000 nuns, about 10,000 lay women, 500 to 1,000 lay men, and everybody living in the monastery and practicing together. And then there's huge numbers of people coming, paying respects all through the day and the night. And but we waited until, I don't know, about 1 o'clock. It was as few people as possible to change the coffin out, because we realized that the coffin that we had used to keep him in was very good hardwood, and we were afraid that it wouldn't give good ventilation. It was solid bottom, so we changed it out so that it would be get ventilation through it for the fire. And then when we opened the coffin up and then started taking away all the stuff, it was there didn't seem to have been any change in Ajahn Chah's. It's just very beautiful complexion. There wasn't any deterioration of the body. So I don't know if that was tobacco or not. I don't know if that worked for everybody. Somebody considered an accomplished being, then after the cremation, then the relics or the ashes and the bits of a bone that come in the fire. Those are actually incredibly sought after, because they turn into, oftentimes they'll turn into kind of crystal relics. And there had been a couple, just before Ajahn Chah's cremation, of highly regarded teachers who'd passed away, and there'd been cremation. There'd been real unseemly sort of scenes at the actual cremation, people trying to get at the ashes. And so we actually designed some people may have seen been to Wat Bapong, but also seen the pictures of this large chedi, a very beautiful, elegant chedi. Well, that was built specifically for the cremation. It took us 6 months to build it, which was a real feat in itself. And then the cremation took place inside, and the chedi was built in a way, so that was the chimney. And then the funeral, the oven, where we put in the coffin to burn, we built it in a way that we could close the door and lock it, and nobody could get at it. And then collected the ashes, and then it was done in a way that we could do it in a very orderly and respectful way. None of them were distributed to anybody. It's all at Wat Bapong. So there's all sorts of different ways. Pardon?
Did you see
that? Yeah. And there's some that are on display. They're a little bit hard to see, but we built a chedi so that the middle part was crystal, so that you could see that, and. They're very different. Ajahn Chah always did things differently. they're very different. Oftentimes how they'll appear is, these like crystal, quite small crystal, or reasonably kind of dense, tight sort of crystal formations. And Ajahn Chah's are almost like coral, and many of them are quite large, this kind of size, rather than small. And there's a few different colors, and then it has this kind of coral-like coral and airy, sort of like almost cellular. I'd never seen anything like it before. So that we have some of those. Then all the rest are down below and concrete slab over it. The chedi is on top of it, and then a granite plinth over top. And they also put in all, there was quite a few amulets that people had offered Ajahn Chah or made for Ajahn Chah for him to bless, to be able to distribute. And Ajahn Chah never did that. He kept them. And then so those are in that plinth in underneath the chedi. Is the pleasant experience when one is abiding inside one's mind a sensation and or a mental formation? Well, primarily, just as I was explaining, that's the pleasant experience, just the Vedana, the feeling in and of itself is Vedana, the pleasant feeling, the sensation. But then, you know, if there's a thought around it, this is pleasant, that's a mental formation. So that's the difference. And so that the sensation, the feeling, is just on that feeling tone, the Vedana, and then any kind of construct that one makes around that, labeling it good or bad or desirable, that is the mental formation. The sensation is just the sensation itself. And second part of the question. Is it a universal energy that is always available and that we only fleetingly tap into when in the calm, open, relaxed, meditative state? I would... I wouldn't sort of call it a universal energy in the sense that that's externalizing it, but a calm, open, relaxed, meditative state is something natural to the mind. It's something that is when we don't. Cover over the mind with some other disturbance, then that's what the mind naturally reverts to. And so it says, well, so much of practice is just learning how to get out of the way. From experience, I know that lots more walking and less sitting is better for pain management. Should I just continue to sit and work on enduring the unendurable, or walk more? I mean, I just walk more. It's because it's because sometimes pain is you can learn a lot from pain, but it also wears you down, So one does need to find ways that one can develop a continuity of awareness of stable, clear states of mind, and walking is a valid practice. Standing is a valid practice. It doesn't have to be sitting as just as the kind of be all and end all of meditation. I tend to give an example of one of Ajahn Mun's disciples when I speak of the options in walking meditation. Lumpu Khao is a very highly respected student of Ajahn Mun, and his primary practice was walking meditation, he would in Thailand after alms round, you alms round early in the morning, you know, like right at dawn, and then the meal in forest monasteries it tends to be kind of early, 8 o'clock, 8:30, and then you're done for the day. You have one meal a day, and they said that would. So Ajahn Khao, after the meal, clean up, go back to his dwelling place, and then he'd do walking meditation for 3 hours, and then he'd go have a midday nap, bit of a rest, get up, go and do 3 hours of walking meditation, and he'd come back, sweep up, do the cleaning chores. Have a shower, have some tea, and do 3 hours of walking meditation, and then he'd start sitting. And so the sitting didn't take place until after he'd done a lot of walking. In studying the sutta on right view, how does one incorporate mentality, materiality? I'm trying to remember the. Is that the discourse of Sariputta?
Yeah,
right view.
But I
can't remember what
exactly.
I can't. I'm not really. It's not fresh in my mind. That's an understatement. So I can't really give a qualified answer. In terms of mentality, materiality, that name and form is another translation. Mind and body, just that recollection of mind and body in its true nature. Seclusion of the heart really interests me, especially because of a busy family atmosphere. Is a way to develop seclusion of the heart to work on not taking things personally, not letting the self-making perceptions, etc., insert themselves into the heart. And that's an excellent way of doing that, because that, certainly the... the ways that we end up what spins the mind out is when we take things personally. Particularly in a family atmosphere, then one still has to be able to engage, take on one's duties and responsibilities. Be. Responsible parent, family member, but it's that just not letting the things kind of it's kind of like when you go for a walk in the forest and oftentimes there's kinds of grasses and bushes that have burrs and whatnot, and they just keep catching on you. And so that if one just developing a way that you know one isn't getting hooked by the reactions that we have. One of the really good examples of somebody who lives with a seclusion of the heart in the midst of responsibilities and duties in the midst of people is the abbot of Wat Bopong, Ajahn Chah's successor, Ajahn Liam. And I can remember him speaking Dhamma a long time ago. And there's a phrase that he uses over and over again that is really an integral part of his practice, and it's sort of the just not being caught by the kind of the gladness or the sadness of the mind, that liking and disliking, and just by not getting hooked by the likes and dislikes, the preferences, the joys, the sorrows that tend to stir up the mind, but still able to be present. Can you say a little more about quote unquote the mind going outside of itself, unquote, what that means and how that is dukkha? With which is a good segue in terms of that joy and sorrow, gladness, sadness, liking, disliking, the mind going outside, the sort of outside of its seat of knowing, outside of its seat of awareness, so that as we hold that. And are able to recognize that base, appreciate its preciousness, and then not be not going out to the reactions of liking or disliking, of wanting, not wanting, of the joys and sorrows, so that as that, because as soon as it moves, the ball gets rolling, and one is hooked into reactive mode, and has lost that base of clarity and stillness, and. And it isn't as if, say, that stillness isn't capable of effecting action in the world. It's like the image that Ajahn Chah uses of still flowing water. So that kind of a paradox of the image of water that's flowing, but it's still, and that is the mind that is, it's steady, it's clear, it's able to engage in activity in the world. Takes on its duties and responsibilities. It flows with circumstance, but it's still. It's still, it's stable, it's steady, but it's able to flow and engage. It's a beautiful image of still flowing water. Dear Ajahn, you once had some recordings of chanting by a very young Sri Lankan boy who was apparently freshly reincarnated from a lifetime 1,500 years ago and chanted in the style of that time, specifically his rendition of the Metta Sutta, How to Find. What's his name again?
Dhammaruan.
R-U-W-A-N. Dhammaruan. And there's also, there's the Metta Sutta, there's the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, there's the Girimananda Sutta.
I think all the Prittas.
And it's, yeah, it's, he's, I don't know, 3-4 years old at the time.
I think
he's
like six.
Six? Yeah. Okay, 6 years old. Is this, he's really getting on. But yeah, all of these chants were coming from memory, from past memory.
He lives in America, doesn't he?
Thus have I heard. He teaches at IMS. Have you heard this? Coming in 2014. Okay. Okay, topics to avoid in conversation for the sake of quote-unquote harmony. Politics, food, money, people who aren't present, sports, scandals, etc. Where is the long list printed? No, it's all through the suttas. There's this long talk of king, talk of robbers, talk of... Google animal talk. BMC, Buddhist, on the Access to Insight website, in Buddhist monastic code, I think it's translated as animal talk. Which is sort of low forms of conversation. What are skillful views and opinions? Ones that don't end up in conflict with others, that don't end up in conflict, don't end up in suffering. And what are the indicators of a Dhammic conversation, dialogue? An indicator would be that it benefits you and it benefits the other person. That sense of having held a conversation and one feels that you've been, both people in the conversation have actually benefited. That's a good indicator. Okay. One day at tea time, a guest at the monastery was sharing her feelings about a coworker who is always upbeat and positive. It irritated this guest because she felt her coworker was not being genuine. I was laughing to myself because at my job, I am that big ball of sunshine most of the time, and it can annoy my coworkers. They love talking about the faults of others, and it irritates them when I counter their comments with something positive about, quote-unquote, their victim. But lately, their habits have been rubbing off, and I find myself fault-finding more and more. Any advice on not getting sucked into negativity would be much appreciated. One is just really recognizing that negativity is kind of toxic and is not really isn't fruitful. And I oftentimes caution people in that sense because it's. It doesn't take a whole lot of wisdom and intelligence to find the faults in things and find the faults in other people. But it does take kind of restraint and discernment to hold a center of when one doesn't have to gloss over. People's faults, one just doesn't have to dwell on them. I think one is really paying attention to the how it feels in the body when people start talking about negative things, because you can really, it feels uncomfortable, it feels unpleasant. There might be a certain glee in having a good rant, but the actual feeling is one of discomfort. So that to pay attention to that and to avoid conversations that if that's where the conversation is going, then just to vacate oneself or do something to so that one doesn't have to participate. Certainly not getting swept up in it. Okay. I'm one of those people who tend to focus on identify with my faults. Could you please talk a little more about ways to stop ourselves from identifying with our characteristics, good, both good and bad? The more that of a more problematic nature is that identifying with faults and flaws and one is just seeing the pain involved and to really acknowledge that one. Yeah, we tend to undermine ourselves by focusing on identifying with the faults and flaws. And it's important to, and I think I mentioned it a few days ago, where one taking on as a practice and making conscious both the thing in terms of actions, not in terms of perceptions. I perceive myself as being flawed and full of faults, but in actual actions, things that one does or says that are both in terms of wholesome, skillful, helpful, and that say have been maybe unhelpful, unskillful, but making the practice something that is say time limited in the sense that one does it once a day, twice a day, three times a day, but it's just from say the period where one say from yesterday till whenever you do this practice to the next time during the day, and it's just during those periods. It's not sort of going back and dragging up all of the evidence of one's miscreant nature. But just keep focusing on those things that one has been engaging in, the interactions that one's had, what emerges is a very different picture than the one we tend to carry around of ourselves. So that it's important to use that as a skillful tool ameliorate the kind of memory perception, and then also to recognize that it's just a negative perception that I have formed a habit around. How to relinquish that. Okay. Could you kindly talk about some obstacles in your practice and how you overcame them as a way to encourage us? A lot of my obstacles, difficulties, I think around doubt, confusion, fear, those were the more major things that I kept sort of bumping up against all the time. So working with the aspects I've always found a tremendous benefit coming from that mindfulness of the body, really coming back, grounding and sustaining attention, clarity, mindfulness in the body, mostly to gain a clarity and stability of mind that could then see those habits and wear them down, wear them out, so that the degree to which sort of kind of greed and aversion play themselves out or more around the kind of delusion aspects of the mind, and so that really focusing on how to, because the nature of delusion is that it doesn't know, so that its only counter is to really establish that quality of knowing more steady, more clearly, and more consistently, and so that's what I found mindfulness of the body extremely helpful in being able to counter those habits and tendencies. I noticed that with increased concentration, the formations of physical fluids decreases. When I start thinking about it, the swallowing reflex and the gurgling in the guts kick in. Please clarify, what is the experience of monks who stay in day-long samadhi? Any association with stages of concentration? It's just the body. That's what bodies do. Yeah. So that, it's just paying attention to, one is with that sense of as we experience concentration, then there's not only a sort of the mind relaxes and the mind becomes at ease, but physically there's an ease that comes, so that things tend to come into balance a lot more. Some things you don't have any control over. The guts will gurgle when they gurgle. Okay, last question. I understand that it isn't okay for any monk or human being to say that they are enlightened. How come that the Buddha himself proclaimed that he is the enlightened one, the knower of the world? Did people write this down or quote the Buddha? There's a one is the some of it is just the epithets that one calls the Buddha, and it's through that extension of a devotional recognition, and some of it is in one has to get the context of in the discourses when the Buddha the first time that the Buddha proclaimed himself to be fully enlightened, and then the reaction was the person who he had just told it to just sort of shook his head and walked away. May it be so, friend. and he realized that wasn't a great approach. That's when his next teaching was on Four Noble Truths and Eightfold Path. So that was a more balanced approach. Also, the Buddha, a lot of the early suttas are before he formulated a rule around it, so that you've got many layers of the discourses, and it wasn't until quite a few years after the establishing of his teaching that the Buddha laid it down as a formal rule. And the main reason is that people were making claims for in order to gain recognition and support. There are times when the Buddha, and in general, the Buddha didn't rely on proclamations of his specialness in order to try to get people to practice. What the Buddha did was point to the teachings, point to the truth, point to the ways of practice, and led people to encourage people to practice. So that it's actually a rare occasion that the Buddha actually did that in terms of straight out up front, sort of saying, proclaiming his kind of accomplishments, and it tended to be in the very early days of the dispensation, and as he continued to teach, and there's a certain skillfulness and skillful means became more refined and more cautious as well, because the if somebody is going to practice just because the teacher is enlightened, then it tends to be a pretty shallow base for practice. If they don't have confidence in themselves, don't have confidence in the teaching, and they're relying on an external being to inspire them and keep them practicing, then that's not a stable foundation for practice. So the Buddha was was extremely wise and skillful, and had people's long-term benefit at heart. So that that it's very rare that he used that kind of proclamation of his specialness as a basis for trying to get people to practice. So we'll have a quick break and come back.